Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday morning and welcome to the show here at KJZZ. I'm Lauren Gilger with Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, we will check in with our colleagues at the BBC in London, live outside of Buckingham Palace as President Trump's state visit with the Queen gets underway today. And we'll have a walk through a new exhibit at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art that shows diversity in portraiture. And a reminder, this summer, from Memorial Day to Labor Day, the show is going to be focusing more on local and regional coverage. We'll have a one-hour program starting at 9 o'clock. That's now. So please continue to tell us about those things that are going on in your parts of the Valley. Email us at the show at kjzz.org.
We begin today's show with a ruling by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals that still leaves Arizona libertarians with an uphill battle to get their candidates on the state's primary ballots. The 2015 state law raised signature requirements, making it harder for libertarians to have their voices heard and potentially affect election outcomes. With us to talk about that and more is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, good morning.
Good morning, and I'm not at Buckingham Palace.
Are you a libertarian, though, is the question. And do libertarians feel like they have not been treated fairly based on either the state law or this ruling by the Ninth Circuit?
Oh, definitely. And you have to understand that the Republicans made no secret of what they were trying to do when they passed this law. You had J.D. Mesnard, who was then in the Speaker of the House and even before, saying, look, we would have won the new CD9 if we didn't have a libertarian in the race, that Vernon Parker would have won and not Kyrsten Sinema. They also said that Ann Kirkpatrick would have been beaten down in CD2 if, in fact, you didn't have a libertarian in that race. So what they've done is made it harder for libertarians to get on the ballot in the first place. And it was successful. I mean, this is the first time, I think, in decades, we didn't have a libertarian on the ballot running for governor.
So Howie, does it not matter? You're talking about letter of the law versus spirit of the law. Clearly, when the Ninth Circuit looks at this, they're looking at the letter. Knowing what we know then, knowing that what you said, that Mesnard and others didn't want libertarians on the ballot, does that matter in any way? Will it affect how laws are written in the future?
Well, here's the deal. Motive matters on certain things. For example, the Ninth Circuit has struck down certain laws where they've said this was done for racial overtones. It was done to keep Hispanics from voting, to keep blacks from voting, or certain other groups. Politics is fair game. And essentially what the Ninth Circuit did is they ignored that and said, look, as a matter of law, the law is fair. It says that every party has to get 1% of the people who are registered either in their party or as independents. Now, if you're a Republican or Democrat, that's real easy. If you're a Libertarian, the number of signatures required can be close to 30% of your members. And theoretically, again, libertarians can go out and get independents, but libertarians don't let independents actually vote in the primary, and they're not too anxious to have independents decide who should be their nominees. So that's why they went to court.
Another quick couple of questions for you on another story this morning, Howie. Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery is once again looking for a seat on the Arizona Supreme Court, and it looks like his odds might be a little better this time around. Tell us about what's going on here.
Well, last time out, well, let's back up a step. The Commission on Appellate Court Appointments screens nominees pursuant to the Constitution. In other words, this isn't like the president being able to name anyone he wants. The governor has to name from the commission, and the commission has to put up a certain number of people. It can't be all from one party. Last time, they sent up several names. Bill Montgomery was not among them. He got 5 yes votes and 7 nay votes. There were a lot of people. There was one who was a unanimous pick. There were a couple more who were like 1 vote against and 2 votes against. But here's what's changed. That 5-7 vote, of the people who voted against him, 3 of them are now gone, been replaced by other people. Which suggests that perhaps, a different panel might have reached a different conclusion. You also have the fact that if he gets to the governor, we know that Clint Bolick, who is one of the governor's picks to the Supreme Court, has lobbied the governor to pick Bill Montgomery originally for the U.S. Senate, so we know that he's got some backing of existing court nominees. What does the governor think? The governor is keeping his own counsel and saying, look, let me see the names that are sent. But I'd say that his chance of getting nominated this time are a hell of a lot better than they were last time.
Yeah, Howie, finally, the timing is interesting because when the finalists came up last time, and as you mentioned, Montgomery wasn't on them, there was also a time where the governor was criticizing how the county attorney's office had handled a particular case involving an officer. This time the governor is mummed. Do you read anything else into that?
Well, I think that the governor is probably generally allied with Bill Montgomery on most issues, the law and order issues, the issues that Bill Montgomery's fought in terms of legalization of marijuana, things like that. It's hard to know. You have to see who else is on the list. You know, the presumption is that he'll name a Republican. He did name one independent, who was Clint Bolick, but Clint was an independent sort of a name only. So we'll have to see the other Republicans that are on the list, assuming Bill Montgomery makes the list. Now, again, remember, the commission has to send up more than one party. So let's say they have three Republicans on the list. They need two Democrats, or a Democrat and an independent. If there aren't enough Democrats and independents they nominate, they only send up one Democrat or one independent. They can only send up two Republicans. So that also changes the calculus on this thing in terms of how many people they can send up.
Hmm. All right. That is Howie Fisher with Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
You're very welcome.
And now let's turn to a story about the ongoing ramifications of the president's threat to impose tariffs on Mexico. Some of Mexico's highest-ranking government officials are in Washington this week. They're pulling out all the stops in an effort to de-escalate tensions over immigration. They want to keep President Trump from slapping punitive tariffs on all imports. This could have broad-reaching impact along the southwest border. To help us understand the situation, we have Jorge Valencia on the line from our Mexico City Bureau. Good morning, Jorge.
Morning, Lauren.
Okay, so what is the central message that Mexico wants to communicate here to President Trump?
The thesis of their argument is twofold. First, they want President Trump to know that Mexico has, in fact, been working really hard at containing the migration from countries other than Mexico arriving at the U.S. border. That's the first half. And the second half, they want Trump to see, or they want to try to show him that putting in place tariffs, which is what he has said would be the punishment if Mexico doesn't stop migration, that putting in place tariffs on imports from Mexico would actually be hurtful for consumers on both sides. And then it also would also be harmful for the Mexican economy, which would make it harder eventually for Mexico to contain migration going towards the United States. There are two key numbers that I want to share with you that they have thrown out. The first one is 80,000. Mexican immigration authorities have deported 80,000 people in the past 6 months. The overwhelming majority of them are people who have crossed into the country on foot trying to get to the United States. And then the second number is 25,000. Mexican immigration officials say that in that same period, they have gotten almost 25,000 applications for humanitarian visas. Now, like you just said, Mexican officials are pulling out all the stops. So there are several members of the Mexican cabinet who are in Washington this week to do some sort of lobbying, if you want to call it that. They're being led by Marta Bárcena, who is Mexico's ambassador to the United States. And so she's saying that without Mexico's efforts, there could be a lot more people reaching the U.S.
Without Mexico's efforts, an additional 250,000 migrants could arrive at the U.S. border in 2019.
So how exactly would these tariffs that are being threatened here impact commerce?
Okay, so I'm going to give you a couple of numbers again, and I'm sorry to be throwing all these digits at you, but the key number is $350 billion. Mexico is the U.S.'s top trading partner, and both imports and exports, and the U.S. imported about $350 billion worth of goods from Mexico last year. That's anything for parts that are used for car manufacturing and plants in the Midwest, to fully manufactured cars, to berries, to tomatoes that we get through the Nogales port from Sonora and Sinaloa. And so putting in place a 5% tariff, which is what President Trump said last week that he would do, would represent $17.5 billion that would be shouldered on companies and consumers in the United States. And I know that's kind of an abstract figure, but to sort of put it in perspective, that is much more than the operating budget for the entire state of Arizona for an entire year. Mm-hmm. Graciela Márquez Colín is the economy secretary of Mexico. She's also in Washington. This is how she put that into perspective.
Imposing tariffs would be very damaging, not for Mexico, but for the supply chains that every day produce goods in Mexico and in the United States.
Okay, so Jorge, you mentioned the amount of people that Mexico has been deporting and some of the efforts they've been making. I know you did a lot of reporting down on Mexico's southern border. What does it look like there? Like, from your reporting and your impression, you know, is Mexico doing enough to stop this?
Well, I wouldn't venture to say whether or not Mexico is doing enough to stop this. But I think what can be objectively said is that Mexico is going through great lengths to stop people from reaching the U.S. And there are a couple of key areas where there has been a lot of change in the past 6 months. In southern Mexico, there have been camps, both formal and informal, of migrants that have popped up over the past 6 months of people who entered Mexico. They were trying to get to the U.S. on foot, and then immigration authorities detained them. Mm-hmm. Many of them, like I said a moment ago, maybe they apply for humanitarian visas, maybe someone will receive it, and then many of them will be deported to their countries of origin. The vast majority of them come from Central America. And in fact, the numbers have increased dramatically. The Mexican, according to numbers from the Mexican government, the number of people crossing in could double basically what they saw last year. And that's just in the southern part of the border. I mean, there are also about 13,000 people that are just on the other side of Arizona, California, Texas, New Mexico, who are waiting there for a chance to basically just be allowed to the port of entry to apply for asylum. Mm-hmm. So Mexico is certainly shouldering a large part of this burden. And I think that that's part of what a lot of people who pay close attention to migration on both sides of the border recognize, and that perhaps President Donald Trump isn't really acknowledging.
So what is the White House saying about all of this as Mexico's leaders are in Washington trying to rally around this?
Well, President Trump as recently as yesterday just sort of shrugged off Mexico's efforts. He said that he knew that there was a delegation that was going to be in Washington this week, and he called it just talk. He said Mexico has been just talk for many years, and that he wants them to just stop migration, to basically to put actions. And I just want to play a little bit of what one of his surrogates said yesterday. It's Mick Mulvaney, his acting chief of staff, and he was on Fox News Sunday.
I fully expect these tariffs to go on to at least the 5% level on June 10th. The president is deadly serious about fixing the situation at the southern border. This is not the first time I'm on your program talking about what's happening on the Mexican-U.S. border.
So as you can tell, President Trump and his team have drawn a hard line. At the same time, they haven't been very clear, because then a lot of questions come up of what exactly does the president mean by he wants Mexico to stop migration? I mean, mm-hmm. we've just gone over some numbers that there are many, many thousands of people who haven't been able to reach the United States because of Mexico's efforts. In fact, like, some academics colloquially or informally have told me that they think of Mexico as really the wall stopping people from reaching the United States. Mm. So what exactly does the president want, and will he go through with this 5% tariff? I mean, he seems totally serious, like Mulvaney said, but what exactly does he want in return? It's not very clear, and hopefully maybe at some point this week we'll get a little bit of a better picture.
Yeah. All right. That is KJZZ's Jorge Valencia joining us from Mexico City. Jorge, thanks as always.
Thanks, Lauren.
Now we're going to check in with the editorial board of the Arizona Republic. It's a weekly segment where we talk about current issues facing the state and the nation, featured in columns on the newspaper's op-ed pages. As the legislative session was drawing to a tension-filled close, Representative Paul Boyer's stance on a bill focused on extending the statute of limitations for sex assault victims to file civil lawsuits against their assailants caused disagreements within his own caucus, as was leading to a delay on the state budget. That caused some in the public to criticize lawmakers who didn't support Boyer, including one on social media, who said Representative Kelly Townsend, quote, favors child molesters. With me for his weekly appearance to talk about all of that is Phil Boas, editorial board director for The Republic. Phil, how did this conflict among some Republican lawmakers really ramp up?
Kelly Townsend and Ben Thoma, a couple of Republican House members, were heard on a hot mic talking about how they might retaliate, you know, politically. This is not uncommon in the legislature, but anyways, it was overheard and by a mic and picked up, and so it drew criticism. And one of the critiques came from a guy named Patrick Mannion, who's just a citizen from Glendale, who accused Townsend of supporting the child sexual abusers, and she really took exception to mm-hmm. it, and that's how we got to where we are.
Yeah. Now. So then she called his employer.
I think it's important to talk about what she did, because she really took vigilante action against the guy. She took a screenshot of his post, his Facebook post, shared it on her Facebook page. She went and researched the guy and found out where he worked, got the name of his employee. She called the man's employer to inform the company what he'd written on Facebook. She demanded to speak to him. She demanded an apology. And all of that that's pretty heavy-handed for a lawmaker to be doing, because lawmakers have tremendous power. They have a lot of authority, and a lot of corporations and companies are cowed by that. And so it can be leverage on somebody, in the end.
All right, lawmakers have a tremendous amount of power. Others will say because they're public figures, they should have thicker skin. She certainly faces criticism and has to be able to accept the criticism. And then at what point is it going to have a chilling effect on the public if lawmakers are decided, oh, okay, I'm just going to go after this person?
Right. So you've talked about a lot of things there, why this is wrong. Okay. This is wrong because, one, it's not appreciating the essential nature of politics. We have politics so that we don't kill each other. Politics is the pressure release valve, using words to settle our disputes instead of going after each other with 2x4s. So the essential nature of politics is that we're going to be loud and boisterous. There was a great line that John McCain used in his final speech to the Senate. He called us a big brawling nation. And that's who we are. I mean, we fight these things out politically, and we get angry, and we get hyperbolic, as this person did talking about Townsend. That's going to happen. Think of how many times that happened with McCain, the things people called McCain a traitor, a collaborator, things like that. Mm-hmm. He wasn't going to go to their employer and try to get them fired or create pressure for them. And to her credit, I don't think Townsend tried to get him fired, but it puts pressure on an employee to do that. She knew it was hyperbole. She practices hyperbole. I mean, she calls the people who want to require vaccination in the public schools communists. That's a little bit over the top. You know, should people be calling Kelly Townsend's employer? And when you have that kind of power, you need to wield it with restraint. You have to be reluctant to use it on a private citizen. Yes, you might be able to. You might have a cannon that you can use. You shouldn't use it. It chills speech, to your point. Mm-hmm. It makes, if you're going to participate in government as a citizen, to know that one of your lawmakers are going to come back and hit you over the head, that might make you reluctant to do that. And this gentleman, he pulled his post from Facebook. So he withdrew from the public debate. Mm-hmm. So
is social media making it so maybe some of our better folks are less inclined, even more so than they used to even run for office, because it is very, very difficult to take criticism of any kind, let alone from a random person, let alone from a person who may mean well but uses language like you're supporting child molesters?
Well, the criticism has always come with the job. And if you can't take criticism, you don't belong in politics, because that's going to be part of it. It is rough and tumble, and you have to take it. And so what Kelly Townsend did, she basically said, you don't mess with me. It sounds tough. It's really weak. Mm-hmm. It's really weak. She needs to be tougher and be willing to take the hits, because that goes with the job.
Thanks, Phil.
Oh, you bet.
Phil Boas is editorial director for the Arizona Republic.
Now let's turn to international news and our weekly check-in with our colleagues at the BBC in London, where President Trump landed just hours ago. He is there for a state visit with the Queen, and Rich Preston is outside of Buckingham Palace now, where all of the pomp and circumstance is set to take place. And Rich, this isn't the first time the president has come to the UK, right?
No, it's not. He was here last year, but that was a working visit. This is his first state visit, which is an official visit hosted by the Queen. He's actually the third US president to get a state visit. Previous people who've had that honor, George W. Bush and President Barack Obama. Mr. Trump arrived at 9 o'clock this morning, London time. That's 1 a.m. for you guys in Arizona. And he was greeted off Air Force One by Woody Johnson, the current US ambassador to the UK. He then made his way into central London, where he was met at Buckingham Palace by Prince Charles and the Queen. at Buckingham Palace, Mr. Trump inspected the Grenadier Guards. Lauren, those are the guys with the big red jackets and the huge, fluffy black bearskin hats that
yes.
you recognise from London postcards. And then he had a lunch with various members of the royal family. And then it was on to Westminster Abbey, where Mr. Trump laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. This evening, that's when the kind of real formalities take place. It's back to Buckingham Palace for speeches and a state banquet. Tomorrow, Mr. Trump has a breakfast with Prime Minister Theresa May, and later on this week he'll be visiting Ireland, where he owns a golf course, and taking part in events to mark the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landings, and he'll be doing that in both the UK and in France. Now, while he's here in London, there are some things that he isn't going to be doing that one may expect from a state visit. He's not getting a procession in a golden carriage down the Mall. That's the big road that leads towards Buckingham Palace, and that's something that most state guests get, but not US presidents. Secret Service, not a huge fan of this big open carriage, and he's also not going to be addressing the British Parliament.
So how has he been received there? I mean, the last time he visited the UK, it was not without controversy.
Yes, that's right. Last time Mr. Trump was here, an estimated 250,000 people took to the streets to voice their anger at President Trump being invited to the UK. Now, that cost British taxpayers an estimated $18 million. Currently, it's a bit too early to say how this visit's gone down. There were certainly hundreds outside Buckingham Palace to see the President arrive this morning when Marine One landed in the garden. But we are expecting demonstrations tomorrow, and numbers circulating suggest it may be as many as were here last time. And the cost that's been tagged to that is around $22 million. Now, Mr. Trump is a divisive president, I don't need to tell you that, and one who's not afraid of offering his opinions. Before he even landed, he tweeted criticism of London's mayor Sadiq Khan, calling him a stone-cold loser. And in an interview with the British newspaper The Sun before his trip, he chipped in on who he thinks should replace Theresa May as Prime Minister, and he commented on the UK's ongoing Brexit negotiations.
So you mentioned the runners to replace Theresa May as Prime Minister. This is a sensitive time for the UK politically. So how is this playing out? Are those people who are running for that position talking about President Trump?
Well, they're being very diplomatic. Now, Theresa May steps down at the end of this week, so they're kind of playing their cards carefully. President Trump offered his support for Boris Johnson, the former Foreign Secretary. He said that he would make an excellent replacement for Theresa May. And he also commented on Nigel Farage, the Brexit Party leader, who he called a good friend. And in fact, Mr. Trump said he'd like to meet them both during his trip. Now, it's not been confirmed whether that will actually happen. And they've not commented publicly on Mr. Trump's comments, though I'm sure they're grateful for his support. Nigel Farage did say, however, that President Trump has come here as a friend and that we should be welcoming him and looking for any potential deals the UK can strike with the US. Some political leaders, however, have said they will refuse to meet Mr. Trump. The opposition Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn has said the president is a climate change denier who uses racist and misogynistic rhetoric. So lots of pomp and ceremony here in London, lots of flags fluttering, but not everyone happy that Donald Trump's in town.
Yeah, all right. That's the BBC's Rich Preston outside of Buckingham Palace. Rich, thank you so much.
Good to talk to you, Lauren.
Mexico-bound pickups weighed down by unwieldy piles of tools, furniture, and appliances are a common sight on Arizona's highways. Many are headed for vast flea markets stocked with goods Americans found no longer useful. Resale is not an easy way to make a living, and profitability can depend on how much gets stuffed into a truck heading south. From the KJZZ Fronteras desks in Phoenix and Hermosillo, Matthew Casey and Murphy Woodhouse report.
Hey,
I'll take 10 for it. It's probably worth $40.
Benito Encinas usually tries to bump yard sale prices down a few bucks. Today he's in Queen Creek looking for tools, which he says are in high demand back home. Encinas spies a mechanic's set of metal auto ramps and tries again.
Hey.
Sometimes owners will bargain. This guy isn't budging. Encinas agrees to the sticker price, pulls out a $20 bill, and the man gives him change.
How you doing, my friend?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Reselling the ramps in Mexico helps Encinas take care of his family. The stop at this yard sale is part of a regular trip to the U.S. that a weak peso has made more expensive. Encinas can't spend too much time trying to wheel and deal because a small army of competitors might buy everything up at other yard sales. But if things go right, Encinas says he'll double the $2,000 he can spend on a trip.
Ganar el doble.
Encinas drives everything he finds in Arizona back to Mexico in a white Ford pickup. His father-in-law helped him build a tall black metal cage into the bed with doors on the tailgate. Packing is a delicate art, which Encinas demonstrates after buying a dining room set. First, he wedges the long wooden table into the bed between luggage and a gas grill. Then he stacks and straps six upholstered chairs to a high platform that extends forward over the cab.
Por ejemplo, en este tiempo hace mucho aire y sí, se mueve mucho el carro.
Encinas says it's windy this time of year, and that means he has to go slower when driving the overstuffed truck more than 300 miles home.
Vámonos, Mateo.
Where reporter Murphy Woodhouse, with KJZZ's Hermosillo Bureau, picks up the story.
On a recent weekend, the Héctor Espino Tianguis, or flea market, is bustling. With well over 400 stands, it looks like every yard sale in Phoenix condensed into the same three or four square blocks. You can find pretty much anything there, and if not a kitchen sink, certainly the tools and parts to fix one. I stopped to chat with Tianguis shopper Marina Martinez and her young daughter, Mariana.
Disculpe, anda de compras aquí. ¿Sí?
Venimos a buscarle productos porque está jugando béisbol.
They came to look at helmets, gloves, and other gear for Mariana's upcoming baseball season.
Aquí encuentras cosas de marca y más baratas.
At the Tianguis, you can find brand names for cheap. And in the U.S., many people sell belongings that are practically new, she says. Melissa Gauthier, an assistant anthropology professor at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, has done a lot of fieldwork in Mexican border tianguis.
People would rather buy a Tommy Hilfiger polo shirt for 25 pesos, knowing that they're going to be able to wash it several times.
For the border's many poor residents, tianguis aren't just a cheap place to shop, she says. They're also a relatively easy to enter market for people looking to earn income. Tianguis aren't minting millionaires, but a modest living can be earned if you can navigate the business's many challenges. Mexico's weak currency shrinks profits for those selling in pesos and buying in dollars. There's also more competition among sellers, driving up prices at Arizona yard sales. With low margins, volume is key. On a recent Sunday evening, Encinas' truck was packed tight and stacked two people high in front of the tianguis after returning from Phoenix. It was a masterclass in spatial relations. His teenage son, Emilio, was working chairs, bikes, and ladders loose from the top in a careful balancing act.
Sí, más o menos es el promedio lo que siempre trae.
He says it's an average load. His dad brings what the truck fits.
Lo que le quepa al carro, pues.
Encina says there's still money to be made in the business, but he's had to adapt. That's meant growing to two stands to allow for more stock and looking for things like tools that pack value into small spaces. But what's always important is a full load.
Si lo traes medio, si no te rindes.
A half load just doesn't pay, he says. You've got to bring a lot, get it cheap, and bargain hard. Murphy Woodhouse, KJZZ News, Hermosillo, Mexico.
Good Monday morning. This is the show on KJZZ 91.5 with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're doing things a bit differently this summer. I want to remind you that from 9 until 10, from now until Labor Day, we're focusing on the stories of our state, and the takeaway will come in from 10 to 11 as we follow this summer schedule. But still, send us your great story ideas at the show at kjzz.org.
Waymo announced last week it will restart its self-driving truck program in Arizona. Our state has become one of the most common testing grounds for autonomous vehicles in the country as leaders have opened up our roads to the new technology. But if self-driving trucks become as pervasive as some industry experts think they will, what will happen to the current trucking industry, which employs nearly 2 million people in the U.S.? To shed some light on that, I'm joined by Rachel Premack, a transportation reporter with Business Insider. So, Rachel, let's start with the current landscape. How pervasive are self-driving trucks right now in the country?
So there are quite a few companies that are testing self-driving trucks. You have Waymo, you have TuSimple, which also has one of these autonomous trucking tests going on. But not that many companies right now are actually making money off self-driving trucks. So TuSimple is an example of a company that does have a contract money-making operation where they have autonomous trucks on the road. But those are only 10 to 30 trucks overall that are actually moving loads and generating a revenue. Most of these trucks are just tests.
It seems, though, that in like the tech world, many of these tech leaders or innovators in this realm really think that this is inevitable. Like at a certain point, and it doesn't sound like from their point of view that it'll be very far in the future, that self-driving trucks will sort of take over this industry. Is that what you hear?
So trucking analysts are kind of split on this. Some of them say it could happen within the next 1 to 3 years, but the vast majority say this is 10 or 20, even 30 years down the road. And the reason for this isn't just the technology, but it's also the legal background to this. So right now, if a self-driving truck gets into an accident with a normal passenger car, the legal parts of this is not clear. So is the manufacturer held, is the manufacturer going to be put on trial? Is it the software? Is it the company that hired the self-driving truck? So there's a lot of legal barriers that are preventing self-driving trucks from becoming ubiquitous at all.
When you talk about legal aspects, is there also a sense of regulation? Like, what about driving across state lines?
Yeah, that's one of the big issues right now, is that there are only certain states right now that permit even the testing to take place. So Arizona is one of the few states where you can actually test self-driving cars.
Right. So as people are predicting the spread of this industry, like, are they also anticipating that the regulatory landscape will vastly change?
They are, but that's, we haven't seen, it hasn't been moving as quickly as I think a lot of tech people might have anticipated or hoped for it to be moving.
Mm-hmm. So then I also want to talk about the impact that this could have, because you said it sounds like even the skeptics in this world think that this is inevitable at some point. It just may be further down the road than in the next couple of years. When and if this happens, then how big of an impact will this have on the trucking industry, which is, as you mentioned, a massive one?
Right. So there are about 1.8 million truck drivers in the U.S. So it's one of the most common job titles in actually many states across the country. And that really leaves millions of people possibly without a job. And the average truck driver right now is around 50 to 55. So that's at a stage where they don't really have the possibility of retraining for a different sort of job. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, a lot of people are saying that because there is this big issue with recruiting for new truck drivers, it's very possible that there simply won't be that many truck drivers by the time that the technology and the regulatory and the legal issues are sorted out. So because of all that, some people say that there won't be as large of a job displacement as the numbers would suggest. And the other thing to note here is that even as the technology is developing, there will still be a need for last mile trucking and last mile deliveries. So what experts are predicting right now is that there will be autonomous trucks that take loads from over long distances. But once they get to those warehouses or fulfillment centers, you still need a person to unload the truck at the fulfillment center and then take it from the fulfillment center to the stores or homes.
So this will be a big deal for that industry, but maybe not in a negative way. Are there opportunities that companies that work with trucking companies and trucking companies themselves are looking forward to?
Right. So once we have these autonomous trucks, Morgan Stanley estimates that there will be savings in the labor side of about $70 billion per year. And those would all be passed down to consumers. And productivity would be up about 30% because these driverless trucks can run 24/7 in the way that obviously human operated trucks cannot. So it is quite possible, according to these experts, that once we have these self-driving trucks, that there will be massive savings for consumer goods across the board.
That is Rachel Premack, a transportation reporter for Business Insider, talking to us about self-driving trucks. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So for our next guest, the question of how we should be preparing for self-driving vehicles goes far beyond trucking. Yona Freeman is a PhD candidate at MIT and one of the authors of a new paper called Are Cities Prepared for Autonomous Vehicles? And he says, with the rise of self-driving cars and trucks, cities have a chance to rethink our roadways. Do they have to be full of traffic? Do they have to be unwalkable? But most cities, he found, aren't there yet.
You know, we have spent the last 70 years or so designing most of the cities in the United States around the automobile. And that's meant basically streets that are very wide, traffic that is congested all the time, environments where it's difficult to walk around, and high rates of people actually dying on the roads. And with autonomous vehicles, cities have an opportunity to think differently about what the streets look like, making them maybe more useful for pedestrians, making them places where people can play in the streets again. And I think that cities really have an opportunity to think more broadly about what they want transportation to be like in the next 30 years. And so I hope that they're thinking seriously about how they can orient their planning in that direction.
Right. So you surveyed almost 150 cities. Is that right about this? tell us what you found. I mean, how many of these cities are actually thinking about these things or are prepared in any way for this?
So one thing we found that was very striking to us is that despite the fact that most of the people we interviewed, about three quarters, believe that AVs or driverless cars are coming really soon in the next 10 years, the vast majority believe also that their cities are not prepared for AVs. So less than 5% felt that their city had a clear plan for these new vehicles. And so to me, that was quite a striking finding because it suggested that there's this new technology. Everyone knows that it's coming. And in some cities, it's actually already in operation in some ways. And yet cities don't really have a clear sense of how they're going to respond to that. And I think that's a concerning issue if we think that planning should play a role in thinking about the future.
So, I mean, here in the Valley, in some of the suburbs of Phoenix here, there are autonomous vehicles operating. I went on a ride along in one of them. It's odd. This is sort of rolling out already, and the state legislature and our governor here have been very open to this kind of technology coming in. So is this about regulations? I wonder if there's a question about laws that should surround this.
That's a great question. One thing that we found was that more than half of the people responded saying that they prioritized technological innovation in responding to AVs. And so I think it makes sense that we're already starting to see cities and states say, we want to have these cars operating on our roads to test out what this is going to be like in the future. And I think that's a great thing. But if you believe that one of the things we can do with AV is change the way our streets work, then we are absolutely going to need new regulations about how they use the curb space, how they interact with traffic lights, whether people, for example, are allowed to walk across streets at certain points that now are considered jaywalking. And so that will require changes in both municipal and state legislation all across our country.
And this is because autonomous vehicles, you don't need to avoid them the way you might need to avoid a driver, right? Like they should be able to detect a pedestrian in the road and stop for them regardless of where they cross.
Well, in theory, that's what we hope. One thing we found was that about 60% of the people we interviewed agreed, you know, that safety would increase with driverless cars. And the general idea with this is that a driverless car doesn't get distracted by text messaging or phone calls or the radio. It can continue to operate, you know, safely, in theory at least, and not run into people. And so what that really means is we can rethink how people interact with the street. Right now, we tell our kids, don't go into the street, you might get run over. And in fact, many people do get run over. But with AVs, when you have a car that is on alert at all times and that has the ability to respond to changes in the environment, we can maybe start having kids playing ball again in the street, reusing the street as a sort of public space. This obviously wouldn't be true for our highways, but it might be true for our neighborhood streets. And that, I think, could be a great opportunity for many of our cities.
That's especially a paradigm shift here in Phoenix. Arizona just was found this year to have the highest rate of pedestrian deaths in the country. We've talked a lot about that in our city councils here in the Valley, et cetera. That could be a huge opportunity, but it also might be scary for people. Like, is there a sense from the people that you talk to of how much you'd have to change your perspective to do this? Like, will it take a generation to feel comfortable walking out in the street and trusting that a car is not going to hit them?
You know, I think what's going to take the most amount of time is that there's going to be this transition period between now and maybe 30 years from now, in which we have both driverless cars and regular cars operating at the same time on the street. And that means that a lot of cities will not be able to take the positive steps forward in changing the street because there will still be regular people driving around their older cars on those same streets. You know, today, obviously, almost every car that's purchased is a regular car with a human driver making decisions. And that those cars are not going to disappear anytime soon. So one question for cities is whether they want to say certain areas of our neighborhoods, for example, our downtowns, will be reserved to just these types of vehicles. And that can open up opportunities. And those can be test beds for the sorts of behavioral and psychological changes that you're talking about. Mm. It can help people get more used to the idea of the street as a public space rather than just a place for movement.
So I always ask this question of people who live in this world of autonomous vehicles because I think it's fascinating. But like, what do you envision this looking like at some point? Like, is there an end game here where there are only autonomous vehicles on the road to you?
That's a great question. Obviously, there are a lot of people out there who still enjoy driving. You know, a lot of people don't like being in traffic, but a lot of people really do like driving out onto a country road and, you know, accelerating, decelerating, et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah. It will take many years until, you know, a city or legislature will be willing to say, we just don't want you to do that anymore. So I don't expect that to be coming anytime soon, that sort of legislative requirement. But what I do expect is this idea that we have certain neighborhoods where we change the rules. And that might come by neighborhoods associations agreeing that they want to see this change. It might come by a downtown group, for example, saying, you know, we don't need everybody to have access to this exact block. We can allow just autonomous vehicles on this block, and that would be okay. And I envision that coming actually pretty soon, because some cities are already talking about creating sort of tech and innovation districts around AVs. And I think that could be a great first step.
All right. Yona Freemark is a PhD candidate at MIT and one of the authors of this paper. Yona, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Portraiture has been a significant part of art for centuries, to the point that for some it's too traditional and associated with older generations rather than our current more diverse population and culture. Artist Shizu Saldamondo has a diverse background herself, born to parents of Japanese and Mexican descent. And the portraits of her friends and relatives reflect that, while also staying true to what is expected of the genre. Saldamondo is being featured in a new exhibit at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art. I met her there recently, and that visit included a look at her portraits and a couple of videos. We started with a sit-down conversation. My first question was about how important it was for people to see others who look like them in her realm of art.
Yeah, I don't know how important it is because I don't know like the demographic of who comes to museums a lot. I know for myself, that's just what I've always really liked to see is people that I can relate to in media or in books or imagery. So I kind of wanted to add to that dialogue and create homages to friends and family that I feel a strong kinship to. So by doing their portrait, it's sort of like an homage piece to them, like dedicated to them. And it's really important to be able to have identifiers and to be exposed and to different forms of imagery that you can relate to and aspire to or feel like you're not so alone, I guess. And I think that's a lot of the crux of the work in a way too in itself, because it's a lot about subculture and music and finding friends and finding a chosen family within musical subcultures, within your own communities, art communities, and finding relatable people that you can hang out with and be family with.
People have their own reactions to art, but is there something that you go into it thinking, I want people to relate to it, or I want people to really come out of it with questions and thinking about it?
I kind of make every piece an homage piece that I hope the people that are depicted like it. So when I'm drawing something, I'm like, oh, I hope they like this portrait of themselves. And that's the first and foremost thought and I guess impetus for creating the work that I kind of want to create. It's like, I hope that their families see it and enjoy it as well, like their chosen families or whoever, there's a kid like in high school that relates to that image or something. That's the first and foremost idea of what the desire to create work and get accolades from that kind of community. As far as like a larger, maybe like high art establishment, I'm not so much thinking about, but that's definitely in the back of my mind. But yeah, for the beginning stages of creating the work, it's more about creating the work for people that are actually in the communities I create work out of, like the social spheres that they traverse and intersect. That's, I guess, primarily who I'm making work for.
Portraiture, it's been such a traditional form. Mm-hmm. Why did you think that genre worked for you?
Yeah, I guess it's weird. It's like there's no rhyme or reason. It was just like what I grew up trying to do when I was little. Just for some reason, I kept drawing faces and wanting to see a relatable image. Whether that's kind of evolved into a more like overt political stance because they're primarily people of color, queer, punks, whatever, I don't know. But I know from a very early on age, even before I had that sort of like political mindset or like before I was aware of these issues, I always drew people too. So I'm not sure what comes first, but having a background and going to college and learning histories and things like that, it certainly informed, I think, a reasoning of where the work comes out of. But when you really think about it from back when I was a little girl, I still did it too before I had that sort of education.
And you always felt like you wanted the portraits to look like the people.
Yeah, realistic. I guess I want them to like their representation. So I'm not so much interested in like abject representations or exploitative or, and I respect art that does do that. I mean, everybody's different in their vision and what they're trying to do. My own, like, I guess reasoning is just out of more of a love and creating it out of a respect for the individual that I draw.
Before we go in, how about self-portrait? Have you done a self-portrait?
Yeah. I have not done a self-portrait since college, since undergrad. I really haven't done any portraits of close, like my husband or my child either. I think I did one sketch of him and I had him draw over it. So it was like a collaborative one. But yeah, I'm not too much interested in depicting myself because I feel like the work is so personal already and that the body of work in the show is almost a self-portrait in itself because it's all my friends and people I care about, which is cheesy, but I mean, that's how I feel. So I don't feel that there's this need to like analyze my face or anything because you can just look at what I love already and what shows I go to or something like that and kind of get a picture.
Okay, so we're looking at one that is really, really fascinating. It looks very Arizona, actually.
Yeah, this one was an image taken of my friend Grace and her son Ira. And me and Grace became friends because our sons are the same age, like only a couple months apart. Her father actually is another really amazing artist, Douglas Miles. And so that's how I came to know her, through him. And we connected and I asked her if she'd be willing to pose for me for a photo for this exhibition because I thought it'd be really great to have some local people within the representing in the exhibition itself. So we had pizza and then we're like, well, is there like a park the boys can run around and then maybe I could take your picture at a park. So the closest one happened to be Steele Indian School Park. And so it was really gorgeous and there was the sunset, it was golden hour, and it was just an amazingly beautiful scene. And her partner mentioned to me the history of the park and what it used to be, and which was the Indian boarding school, and kind of shared with me how they had tried to honor that history in a certain way, but also reclaim it. And so they invited some elders to come and help with the design process and what was going on. And so the title is Grace and Ira at and Despite Steele Indian School Park because of that. And it's kind of like bittersweet because she's a working mom and she's able to care for her own child now. It's not being like Ira's not being taken from her and forced to stay in this boarding school.
What are the other elements here? Coming off the tree or these?
Yeah, so there's a lot of glitter involved. I thought it would be great to amp up the golden hour aspect of the time that the photo was taken, but also there's glitter and paper collage and plastic sequins and spray paint, gold spray paint. I really appreciate craft and the context and the aspects of wood too, because there's on wood panels. And my grandparents and my family were in the Japanese American internment camps, and so they did a lot of like found wood sculpture, like because they're kind of self-taught artists, my grandparents. And so it was sort of like an homage to craft with using wood. And it becomes like it's ready-made landscape with the wood grain. And the wood kind of ages over time and changes too, so which is a really nice aspect of using wood panels as a backdrop.
So now we're walking around the corner and we see a big screen with video. Can you talk about the videos a little bit?
Sure. So this video, the larger one, is a documentation of a punk ska show that happened in East LA at Self Help Graphics and Art, which was a Chicano art center in East LA where I used to work at between schools. So I would work there after undergrad and work in the office. And they would have, it's a, like a multifaceted nonprofit. And so they would have shows in the parking lot. This is like a really small, dusty parking lot that they would rent out for different promoters to have punk shows or whatever bands were playing. They'd have quinceañeras in the hall and they have a gallery and a silkscreen studio. So this was a documentation of one of the concerts that happened and they hosted. And it's called Ouroboros Revolutionary Cycles or Dancing in a Circle. And I kind of thought it was really beautiful. And so it's like kind of a honoring of the new generations that are coming up and the new scenes that come up, and not as a threat, but more of just different cycles and different ways subculture kind of emerges and ebbs and flows into different other things. Yeah.
That is artist Shizu Saldamondo. Her portraits are currently featured in an exhibition at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, or SMOCA.
Today is the third anniversary of Muhammad Ali's death. The boxing legend passed away at the age of 74 after a long fight against Parkinson's disease.
To honor his legacy as both a legendary boxer and as a philanthropist, West Merrill Street between Central and 3rd Avenue in downtown Phoenix will be renamed Muhammad Ali Way. The road runs near the Muhammad Ali Parkinson Center at Barrow Neurological Institute. The city of Phoenix is also declaring June 3rd today as Muhammad Ali Day to highlight his life and contributions to the city.
Ali became a giant of charity in Phoenix in the 1994 Fight Night, a charity event that morphed into the Celebrity Fight Night. Ali was one of the featured guests there for over 20 years.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.